Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Let's be honest here. Most of us are brushing our teeth all wrong, not for long enough, and forget to change our brushes on time. I mean, that is definitely true of Megan. Let me just say that about her.
He knows.
I know. And that is because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip.
So what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes. Also, Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist-recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides.
With Quip's subscription plans, they're focused on your health. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. And check this out, Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth, which for Megan is pretty much everywhere, I think.
When I don't forget them at the Airbnb after the LA Times Book Festival.
That's right.
Finally, everyone loves Quip, including me. I just got mine. It's been featured by Oprah, Time Magazine, and having the distinction of being the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. So Quip starts at just $25. And for all you fully booked fans, if you go to getquip.com/Kirkus right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush.
Again, that's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/Kirkus. GETQUIP.com/Kirkus. Do it for your teeth.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm staff writer Megan Labrice.
And this week, we are excited to talk to Catherine Coulter, who has been a best-selling thriller writer for a number of years now. Her latest book is titled Paradox, and it's the 22nd in her FBI thriller series, starring Sherlock and Savage.
And her 83rd novel overall, Clay. Yeah. 83rd.
Yeah. It is kind of amazing and bizarre. Hats off to her. But she started out in romance. She now also has a series with another best-selling thriller writer, J.T. Ellison. That's the Brit in the FBI series. So she has ranged far and wide. She also, for her graduate work, studied early 19th century European history. So she's a really fascinating person.
To me, she's one of, like, she's in the pantheon of, like, those literary supersellers. Most of whom, curiously, are born, I believe, in the 1940s, like James Patterson and Danielle Steele.
Yeah.
You know, those people, when you go to the public library and you see just like shelf upon shelf upon shelf of their name.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm excited.
Yeah. She's someone who knows how to weave a story really well. So, and she's also really funny. So this interview turned out to be a lot funnier than we thought it was, given that what happens in her novels. So.
I know. I'm actually suppressing a laugh right now to preserve the quality of the podcast, but it was a scream. She was so great.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun. Well, let's call her up.
Let's do it. We have to start out by giving a little bit away, but the thing is, that's so delicious about your book is that is all of the layers of reveal, like the onion, right? So I don't want us to go too far. So I'll ask you to please take the lead and tell our listeners a little bit about what Paradox is.
Okay. Like most of the other preceding 21, oh, can you believe that? 22 FBI in the series. Like
no.
Most, like the preceding FBIs, mainly, there are two separate plots going on at the same time involving different people. But of course, Savage and Sherlock are the thread that run through all of them. You know, they're the focal point. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the plots hook up and sometimes they don't. This was, these two plots do hook up which pleased me very much. I was driving down the highway, and that's why it's dangerous if you have a rider coming towards you, because riders are always plotting. It seems to be the bane of our existence. You know, you're going through and say, well, now we have this happen. No, that's not right. Let's try blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden, going through the Robin Williams Tunnel, I had the epiphany of how they hooked up. So that was a very good thing. So I think the readers will enjoy that. And of course, that is kind of I've kind of ruined it already. Shoot. Well, we have a threat to Sean Savage. We have a haunted house. We have someone who is really quite insane, out for revenge. I have an exploding, a blowing up cathedral. Hey, listen, we have it all. I even have skateboarders in there.
You do. And how you managed to wrangle, especially the blowing up cathedral and the skateboarders into this narrative, bravo. I didn't see that coming.
Did I get you at the very end? I'm not going to have you tell anybody what that's about, but did I get you? Was it out of a total surprise?
Absolutely. And had I been the owner of pearls, I would have been clutching them.
You would have been clutching your pearls?
I would have clutched my pearls in the shock of it.
Clay, yeah. She's good. She's good.
You mentioned this is the 22nd book in the FBI series. I mean, what is it like, really, returning to Savage and Sherlock so often? I mean, how do you keep things vibrant?
Oh, well, let's assume that, yes, we do keep them vibrant. So that's a very nice inference on your part. What I used to do, you know, I also have written a whole bunch of historical romances, and they have mysteries in them usually, because that's how my brain works. And there is some occasionally woo-woo, because that's how my brain works. But the fact of the matter is, the historical romances are such an utterly disparate genre from a suspense thriller that what I found it did was it unconstipates your brain. You know, it keeps your brain from getting constipated because you're changing genres and they are so utterly different. And then what happened after I had hooked up with J.T. Ellison to write the Britain the FBI series, that was two big books a year, and I just couldn't do a third. It's kind of, so I kind of replaced that with novellas, historical novellas. And that's a series as well. And the third one will be out this fall. And that helps. But I will be honest, it's difficult when when the train is running on the same track all the time. It makes it difficult because you're going, you know, it's like you're going to Philadelphia to New York every single time rather than Montana, mm-hmm. you know, to mix things up. So it is a challenge. It certainly is. The Brit book certainly helps, but again, because it's more, that series is more James Bondy.
Right.
With really, I mean, it's just nonstop, I'm going to set your hair on fire. These are more mysteries with, you know, like blah, 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 blah.
Nice. What a weird time it is to be writing about the FBI. I mean, you've been writing the series that Paradox is a part of since the 90s. But as someone who thinks about the FBI quite a bit, I just sort of wonder what your thoughts are on what's happening in our government right now and President Trump's penchant for sort of vilifying American intelligence agencies.
Well, I'm certainly not going to get into that. Mm-hmm. But what I will say is that I don't know if you guys are aware, but the FBI has a unit at the Hoover Building, the headquarters in Washington, and they're responsible for knowing everything that's written about the FBI in the known universe, maybe the unknown universe, too. I initially just picked, in the very first book when I wrote it, I initially made the guy an FBI agent because, like, hey, why not? You know, I really didn't give it any deep thought at all. And then I realized, as I was going on, this is not good. I don't know what I'm talking about. It was interesting because then they called me.
Mm.
And it was about 7 months before 9/11. And if it had been after 9/11, you know, a cockroach couldn't get into Quantico. I mean,
right. They
really closed things down. But this was about 7 months before 9/11, and I'm very pro FBI. And mm-hmm. so they brought me in, and I had an assistant director who was my mentor for the day, showed me all over the Hoover Building. I got to meet everybody, went out to Quantico, got to meet everybody. And what I came away with, other than so many people who were willing to answer every question I had and to help me, is I met the class that was going through agent training at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2000, it was a 16-week full plunge deal. Now it's 20 weeks, I believe.
Yeah.
But everyone I talked to, they wanted to help. They wanted to make things better. You'd see father, daughter, mother, son, grandfather, son. I mean, on and on and on. It was a huge family, and I didn't meet anyone who was, excuse me, an asshole. They all wanted to do good. Now, you take all the other agencies like the CIA, the NSA, all those acronyms. They were historically their own separate little fiefdoms,
right,
which allowed something like 9/11 to happen because nobody talked to anybody else. Don't you come into my turf and screw around. And so then they realized this, President Bush and the whole group realized the fiefdoms have to stop. And for a while there, people were forced to, like, excuse me, work together? Like, let's try to keep our country a little bit safer.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been a lot of backsliding, and again, we've gone to fiefdoms, and alas, what has also happened is all the agencies which should be focused on keeping us safe have been politicized. And of course, anytime anybody, anywhere, in any situations, says something, there's going to be someone to disagree, okay? There is no such thing as agreement between any more than two people. And so what's going on, it depends really on what side you're on, I think. And what I find tragic about the entire situation, that it ever had to become politicized, that it was ever involved in a political crisis as it was in the election. And that's just, it's bad for us. It's bad for the country because it diffuses the bottom line attention that we all need to have on us. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the rank and file in the FBI, they are great people. And I'll never forget, in one book, I had to have a letter sneaked in to the Hoover Building without anybody seeing who did it. And so I wrote it, and then I called up my contact person at the FBI, and I said, can I do this? And they said, no. But then what they did was, there was a conference call, and we worked out how to achieve it, okay? They do not want mistakes. I'll never forget, they told me once, this one woman, she says, I keep telling Jimmy he can't do this, he can't do that. That's Patterson,
mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, they really want to get things right. And in the last book, Enigma, I don't know if you read it, but it involved the kidnapping of a baby out of the nursery in the hospital. I knew nothing about this. I called them up and I said, help. I spoke at length to the supervisor of the CARD team. These are the people who are focused only on kidnappings out of nurseries. I learned the procedures. Do you know now that they have security tags fastened to the baby's umbilical cord and to his ankle? They now have guards in the frickin' nurseries.
No.
But then this is a special group of FBI agents, and when this happens, man, they're on it. There's another group that goes for kidnappings of, like, children and adults. But again, they are so helpful, and I found this true too of police departments across the country. I think I've had a couple who kissed me off. But they're not going to shoot you if they say no. So I guess what I'm saying is people I have found in trying to find out facts and working with people with different agencies, primarily the FBI, is they are really, really helpful. And does it make a difference because I'm published and more than my family read my books? Very probably. They might kiss off someone who is not published. I do not know. But I have found them extraordinary. The CIA is a different matter. That's a totally different matter. I can't even go there.
Yeah.
Well, I'm doing a little bit of CIA in the book I'm writing right now, and talk about hen's teeth and pulling them. We will see. So I went on and on, and are you asleep yet?
No.
No, that was great.
I'm wide awake.
It's just so interesting to me because I didn't know that the FBI would really cooperate with writers in this way. It's really interesting to know.
Oh, they want things to be correct.
Yeah.
I remember I had met the head of the behavioral sciences unit, and that's profiling darlings, which is ghastly. It's just ghastly. People burn out. The average is like 3 years before they run screaming to the hills, you know?
Wow.
And he has been wonderful. You know, he emailed me, he said, my daughter stole my 11th hour cap and I can't get it back and blah, blah, blah. They are people and they want to do a good job. Just like you guys want to do a good job, I want to do a good job. And there are only the idiots putting them in situations that, you know, again, the politicizing of America is just very tragic and very sad, and I'm sorry. But again, you say something, somebody else is going to shoot you.
Right.
You know, there's so much disagreement. There is a rupture in my own family, and it's just absurd. And I'm sure you guys are seeing it too.
Sure.
So I do not ever, ever, ever talk religion or politics, period. Because it's stupid. It makes no sense. What is your point?
Right.
It makes no sense.
So instead of that, let's talk paradox more.
Exactly.
Which actually, this book is a very fine example of the FBI and local law enforcement working together after maybe a little bit of a wondering whose jurisdiction a particular crime will be. But they work together very well throughout the book, I would say.
Well, at the very beginning, I made Savage again. He's not. There is a tendency of the feds, and of course this is in books throughout because people don't care enough to really call in and check. There is occasionally when the FBI comes in that they will maybe in some cases treat the locals like gophers.
Right.
But I make a big point that Savage is not like that. Because he wanted to grow the CAU, the criminal apprehension unit. He wanted local law enforcement to know about that unit and how they could help. So I always make a big point of playing nice.
Yeah.
That's so important. Again, there are individuals who are idiots, and there are idiots in every walk of life. You know that.
Unfortunately,
you probably know some.
A couple. One or two. You mentioned earlier that there's a dual storyline in this book, and I think we've definitely made mention that Savage and Sherlock, who are married FBI agents and parents to a precocious 5-year-old boy named Sean, there's kind of like the family storyline, and there is this one that centers kind of on a local crime, and the local law enforcement lead on that is Chief Ty Christie of Willacott, Maryland. Is this a new character for you?
Yes, she is brand new. I will use former characters. I'll weave them in and out if they're in the unit, usually, but I do like new characters. I do like new characters, and she is very cool.
She's so cool. She's formerly of Seattle PD Vice.
Yep.
She moves out to Maryland, kind of for a slower way of life, you know, cool local town where you can get delicious peach pie at the diner and know everybody's business. I grew up in such a town. She witnesses, is it too much? Can I say that what she sees on the lake one morning?
No, because it's at the beginning of the book. I mean, she witnesses her first murder, and she just can't freaking believe it. You know, oh, my God, what's going on here? And then that just kicks everything into gear.
Yeah.
But what I thought was really cool was she calls, you know, she calls the FBI because an agent is missing. And she ends up with Savage's boss, who's Jimmy Maitland, and he's been in every book since the beginning. He is super cool. He's this big dude. He's got four big sons, and the wife is like 4'11" blonde, you know. I mean, so he's in all the books, and he's really a good character. He's a solid person and a man. He's a solid man is what he is. And he sets everything into motion then with Ty Christie and with Savage. It goes from there. It was very interesting because the missing FBI agent, his name, and I swear to you guys, this happens a lot. It simply came out of my fingers on the keyboard. And the name was Sala Porto. And I said, what? What an idiot name is that? And then it turned out, because I had not in the beginning intended him to be much of anything. Yeah. And then look what happened. And that was his name. What could I do? Things always are happening and changing and twerking and whatever. It's fun.
Going back to the past, I mean, I want to ask you about Georgette Heyer, because you're a big fan of hers. And she was the British writer who's really credited with starting the sort of historical romance and more specifically Regency romances.
Yes.
What do you like about her work?
First of all, Clay, just so you know, the Brits pronounce it Heyer.
Heyer, okay.
Yeah, I always pronounced it Heyer, too, and then when I was in England, got firmly corrected. So just passing it along to make you feel crappy.
Yeah.
But, I read her when I was a kid. She died in 1974, and she wrote a lot of, she wrote in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. Actually, she wrote till the end, but she also tried her hand at mysteries. They're not bad, but she actually started the entire Regency genre, which is roughly from like 1800 to 1824. The Regency, the actual Regency in England was 1810 to 1821. George III went nuts, and he was finally set aside, and his son, who became George IV in 1824, took over. And, he was immensely unpopular. He spent money on everything. He was a fat pig. He was disgusting, blah, blah, blah. But this was the period when Napoleon was running around in Europe. And it was also the period of Beau Brummel. And it was the period of style from men.
Mm-hmm.
Men probably spent as much time at their toilette, darling, as women. I mean, it was amazing. And women wore these thin little dresses, and sometimes they would even dampen their petticoats so they'd be more alluring. I mean, amazing stuff. And then, of course, the dye of pneumonia. God knows. But Georgette Heyer, one thing I have always, when I give writing workshops, I say, use no more than 3 exclamation points in a book. Do you understand me? She uses them nearly every sentence. And you don't even notice because she is so magical.
Uh-huh.
She's magical to me. And I read her, and when I wrote my very first book, you need to have the brain to realize that if you're taking on a something like a novel, you want to cut down on the unknowns, because that's a huge unknown enough in itself. So I took what I knew. I knew the Regency period. In fact, my master's degree is in early 19th century European history. So I knew the period. I knew what they were. I knew what everybody was doing. I knew the political situation. So that was one less unknown to go into it. And I knew Georgette Heyer like the back of my hand. So I knew exactly how to approach things. But there's never been anyone to even get close to her at all. I mean, her mysteries are not tens at all. And in fact, all the Regency romances are not tens, but I'd say like the top dozen of her books are just phenomenally done. I mean, you are just grabbed and drawn in. So that's probably why. And she really, really influenced me.
Yeah.
For those first books. And then Agatha Christie, though, is the biggie.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know? I don't know if you know, there's no way we'd even know this, but Georgia Hare, her daughter-in-law, in a public interview, proudly stated she had never read any of her mother-in-law's books.
Oh, gosh.
Can you imagine?
That's kind of
and
rude.
I think the same was kind of true of Agatha Christie. I mean, it just astounds me. Anyway, moving right along before I get you totally going to California instead of Montana.
Oh, no. I mean, if I had I learned history from you, I would have paid attention. I sure the hell would have. But now that we're talking about other books, I'm wondering what you think about, like, your book is such a symphony. There are countless characters in here. Some of them get introduced in a line and we learn so much about them and then we don't see them really again, like Harlot Henson. She's a retired nurse who helps dredge, you know, the lake when they're looking for something.
Harlot. Yeah. Yes.
Grandmother.
Yeah, she just kind of disappeared.
Yeah, she's grandmother to six Hellraisers and owner of Slumberhouse B&B, and she has bobbed gray hair. Like, we learn all this stuff about her that lets us know that she's much bigger than her role in the story. Like, everybody's going off to live their lives after this, but there are so many characters in here.
Well, it's just that you want to make each character, no matter what they do, you want to make them real.
Yeah.
If they're there for a second, at least they're real. They're not throwaway characters.
Yeah,
you never want to do that.
And I loved every one of them. I loved learning about her. But I was wondering, like, what you think about these thrillers that are coming out now that kind of, like, hinge on a cast of, like, five or six people or even fewer, and the surprises are, like, you know, who's going to be the killer of just, like, five people, you know, because of the unreliability of the narrators. What do you think about those?
Well, actually, I had never heard of the term unreliable narrator until JT told me that one of her books had an unreliable narrator. And I said, what does that mean? She says, oh, well, the narrator's lying to you. And I said, well, but why? I mean, this is like a contract. When you read a book, it's like a contract between you and the author. The author shouldn't lie to me. Oh. I mean, come on. Oh. No, I don't like that. It's not that, not only don't I like it, I don't understand the purpose. Mm-hmm. I can't get my head around it. And because it's a dinosaur head, you know, and it's tough. It's a big head, and it's tough to get around that.
Oh, that's so good.
So back to early 19th century European history and your graduate degree, what drew you to study that period in the first place?
Well, I love history. Mm-hmm. I love history. Like, Constantinople fell in 1452. I mean, I just love history. And the historical romances, I got bored with writing in the Regency, so I went back to medieval times. Mm-hmm. So I'm an expert in the year 1270 to 1280. Then I got bored with that, and I went back to the Vikings. So I learned all about the Vikings, and I'm an expert in the Vikings at about 920 AD. So, you know, history has always just been a wonderful thing. There was a number of volumes written by Will Durant, not Kevin Durant, my wonderful basketball player, but Kevin Durant and his wife Ariel, and it was the history of civilization, and he made history live. I just always loved history, and then when I really fell in love with Georgia Hare and I started reading more and more and more about that period, it was a natural thing simply to go on and really get into the nuts and bolts of the whole area and what was going on then. So it was kind of a natural progression.
Now, I have to, you know, scratch my itch on this one and ask, are you a chocoholic?
Not really.
Because chocolate played an unexpected and delightful recurring role in this book, Paradox. And chocolate chip cookies specifically. And also...
Sean loves them, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Sean. Okay, Sean's the choco chipaholic.
Well, the grandmother makes him chocolate chip cookies and he'll just do anything for her, you know. I hadn't really thought of it like that. I thought more of the cookies than the chocolate. Well, give me a Toll House. Bring the Toll House. Yes.
Yes. But there is at least one very notable chocolate bar in a very exciting scene that's set at a book festival in this small town.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. A 5-pound bar of chocolate.
Can you imagine?
No. You just lie on it and just start, just lie down and then, like, just start eating your way through it, never moving. Yeah, that would be fun. If it had nuts in it.
Of course.
That was a neat scene to write with McGurk, the author, the kid's author. Ah.
Yeah, it's this author, Remus McGurk, creator of Captain Carr Corbin, Intergalactic Space Marauder, and his sidekick Orquette, a terrier who, he's hungry for chocolate?
Oh, he loved chocolate. Yes, I see where you got that impression now. I have no idea why that came out that way. I really do not. It just happened. Oh, another character that will appear in most books is Marty, the little girl.
Yeah.
That will be, you know, she'll be Sean's future wife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, he has about 3 future wives to date. But she's his number one.
That could be its own series.
Yeah.
Well, you wonder what he'll be like when he grows up, you know. What will he be like? Who knows?
Well, Catherine, thanks so much for your time. We both loved Paradox, and it is out right now.
This was such a delight. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for the experience of this book and for today's conversation.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
If you like Fully Booked, you're not going to want to miss Beyond the Darkness here on Podcast One. It's a weekly look at all things paranormal with world-renowned researchers and experiencers. They challenge everything we think we know about ghosts, ghouls, angels, demons, aliens, monsters, and more. So check out Beyond the Darkness weekly on Podcast One, podcastone.com, and Apple Podcasts. Also remember to rate and review. When you think about it, and I do, the jacket of a book is a lot like its underwear. It keeps everything comfortable on the inside and looking fashionable on the outside. And whether you are an open book or a deep, intense novel, you should have the best underwear to present to the world. And that's MeUndies.
MeUndies are made with a material sustainably sourced from beechwood trees. Their naturally soft fiber makes a fabric that won't sag down or ride up. With MeUndies, you can get undies sent right to your door. No more hunting around for the perfect pair at a crowded store. MeUndies is so sure you'll love your first pair that if you're not happy, they'll do whatever they can to get you into the right pair. And if they can't, keep them and they'll refund you. So it really is risk-free to try the best underwear ever.
For listeners of Fully Booked, you get 15% off your first pair of MeUndies and free shipping. Just go to MeUndies.com/Kirkus for your 15% off your first pair, free shipping, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. In fact, since we are overflowing with generosity, here's an extra gift for you. Order a pair, take a screenshot of your transaction, send it to us, and Podcast One will send you another pair. You get one for 15% off, and then another pair from us, free.
The first 25 people to send a proof of purchase, a screenshot of your purchase, or of the receipt, will send you another pair free. Just send your proof to gift@podcastone.com, put Kirkus in the subject line, and you'll soon have another pair in your collection. Again, that's gift@podcastone.com.
One more time, MeUndies.com/Kirkus. Check it out.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
That was great.
That laugh, first of all.
I love her, man.
I love her laugh. We don't normally get that laugh from the writers we interview, so.
No, we don't. Oh, man. I wish we could have her on as special historical correspondent, Catherine Coulter, who could help us place everything in context. Oh, my gosh. That was great.
Yeah. And also in historical context, she knows so much about history. But also you just have to admire her longevity and work ethic. I mean, she's, you know, publishing 1 to 2 novels a year she's been doing that for a while now. So.
And honestly, this book is so intricate. I mean, to keep track of everything and to make it work the way she does, I'm like, I bow to her. And and on top of that, sidebar, this is her, I believe, 83rd novel. Mm. I don't even know 83 people, Clay. How does she come up with people to whom to to dedicate these books to? Right. I guess you have to start, you know, dedicating it to your podiatrist or something.
Yeah. Or she could auction off the dedication to a nonprofit and they could name who the donor gets to have a book dedicated to them.
Amazing.
Yeah. So we found this interesting sort of paragraph of writing advice that a literary agent in New York, Meredith Kaffel Simonoff, has written for Poets and Writers, the magazine. Tell me your thoughts about that, Megan.
Yeah, this is cool because this is something I saw a lot on social media because, you know, I'm connected to writers, agents, publicists, mm-hmm. et cetera. That's pretty much my little social media world. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were pulling this quote from what Meredith had to say in her advice to writers. And it's, quote, "My advice to any aspiring writer is to take a break from your manuscript and write your own treatise on why you write. Be as precise, as rigorous, as searchingly honest as possible. Discover and own what drives you and honor that drive with everything else you create. If your answer doesn't inspire you yet, push yourself to read more widely, more daringly, until your awareness of your own intentionality is as honed as a newly sharpened tool, as polished as a gemstone," end quote. And leading up to that advice for writers, she quotes several famous writers, Joan Didion included, Zadie Smith, why these people said that they wrote, what was their goal?
No, and it's interesting to recall why George Orwell writes, because he has this famous work, Why I Write, and his four reasons, just honed very briefly, are sheer egoism, which is a great one, aesthetic enthusiasm, historical impulse, and political purpose. And of course, political writing for him was quite important. That's not true of every writer, of course. So
that's true.
But it's just, it is great advice because, you and I get asked all the time when we do panels and stuff, from if there are writers in the audience who want to get published, what can I do? And, this is great advice. Understand deeply why you yourself write and why your writing matters.
Yeah. And it's advice I don't think that, those questions get a lot at those panels. And most of those panel questions, most of them are, to that end.
Yeah.
That's what people
want. Which you can understand because, publishing is a little bit of an opaque industry. Getting into it can be a little, breaking into it can be a little tricky. So.
Yeah.
But this is great advice. So we encourage you all to look it up. It's on pw.org, which is Poets and Writers Magazine.
And for aspiring writers who want to query Meredith, her company is Di Fiore and Company. That's
she does a lot of literary fiction herself. Agents a lot of literary fiction. So I think it might be time to call up our editors and see which bestsellers this week they think you ought to pay attention to.
Oh, it's definitely time. And they are going to be so sad that they missed Catherine earlier. Yes. I wish they could have listened in.
Well, they can always listen at their desk instead of editing reviews, but then I would get mad at them for not editing reviews. All right, let's call them up. All right, we've got our senior editors on the line. We've got Vicki Smith is our children's book editor. Laura Simeon is our young adult book editor. And Laurie Muchnick is our fiction editor. So Vicki, what are you liking in children's books this week?
I'm liking a book that some people might consider a sleeper, although the author, Sandra Markle, has a pretty substantial fan base among teachers and librarians. She is a really distinguished author of science books for kids. And this book that I'm excited about right now is called The Great Rhino Rescue. And it is a heavily illustrated book for middle graders about efforts to save the southern white rhino. And Markle is really good at the way that she's able to take, she focuses on one particular mother rhino and her calf who are targeted by poachers. And because rescue is in the title, it's not going to end badly, which is really important. But she's able to take this story of how the mother rhino and her calf are targeted and then rescued. And she also, in between, braids in all sorts of information about rhinos and why they're being poached, and you know, how encroachment on savanna habitat has affected rhino populations and so forth. There's a lot of kids who don't want to read novels. You know, they're thick, they just don't want made up stuff. And this particular type of book is really ideal for them. So for people who are hoping to get their not incredibly enthusiastic kids, or not incredibly enthusiastic about reading kids, get them into the library this summer and get them a book that will really sort of get them excited. This is the sort of book that I think they should look for. It's an adventure story, and it's got real information. And it's really upbeat. You know, it's about a serious thing, but it also doesn't just sort of beat kids over the head with gloom and doom. There is hope for the rhino. And that's really important for kids to get in their nature books, I think. So that's what I am liking.
Vicki, I was wondering what the artwork is like.
It is fabulous. It's all photographs. Well, you know, there's some charts in here, but it's almost all photographs. And I got to tell you that baby rhinos are incredibly cute. And I would not have known that before opening this book, because it's got this really, really adorable baby rhino who's just got this little nub on its nose, and it is just the most adorable thing ever. And, you know, the adult rhinos look awfully good, too. You know, the photographs are really quite spectacular. Rhinos wallowing, rhinos running away, rhinos nursing. They're great.
Really cute baby rhinos with a happy ending just sounds like the book that we all need right now.
Yeah, maybe that's one of the reasons I picked it out too. I need it as much as the kids do.
As you were speaking, Vicki, I Googled southern white rhino calf, and I found this picture. It's like bucking a little with its four legs off the ground and its little nose nub, and it is just as cute as can be.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So thanks for the recommendation.
Sure.
Turning now to YA. Laura, what have you got for us?
Well, I have a great book. It's not as cute as Baby Rhinos, but but it did get a Kirkus star. It's If Only by Jennifer Gilmore. And it's a story that I think will really resonate with a lot of teen readers. It's told in from two points of view, alternating chapters. So one protagonist in the year 2000 is Bridget, who's 16 years old. She finds herself pregnant, her boyfriend breaks up with her, and she's trying to decide, you know, what to do. And in the end, she gives up her baby girl for adoption to a lesbian couple. And then the other voice is Ivy in 2017, who is 16 and is the daughter, you know, Bridget's biological daughter. And Bridget chose the name Ivy, you know, chose the family she'd go live with. But when Ivy was a baby, Bridget sort of dropped out of the picture. She left behind letters, but she's no longer in contact. And Ivy's been really happy, but, you know, she's curious about this birth mother she doesn't know, and she decides to try to find her, and it's this sort of exploration. And so you have the two teenager stories juxtaposed, but then in between, one thing that makes the book really fascinating, I think, is there are these if-only sections where it sort of speculates about what Ivy's life would have been like if she'd ended up growing up in a different family, adopted by someone else, which I think is something a lot of, you know, kids and teens, you think about, like, what if these weren't my parents? What if I had a different family? So,
oh, totally. I love this idea.
Yeah. So it's a thoughtful, interesting book.
Now, Laura, one of the things that really intrigued me is what feels to me like a very short span of years between the Bridget story and the Ivy story. And it really sort of hit home for me again, just how short the teen reader's sense of history is. And one of the things that really struck me when you were, you know, talking about this and when I was looking at the review, Laura, is the really short span of time between Bridget's story and Ivy's story, you know, 16 years, which is an entire generation for Ivy, but which feels like just yesterday for me. And it gets me thinking about how we understand historical fiction, because I think that a lot of grown-ups, and I use the term sort of fairly loosely, but we think of historical fiction is stuff that happened in our pasts, and we don't think enough about stuff that happened in the pasts of the kids who are reading the books. And this seems like a really good way to bring that home to grownups as well as kids, is how very fluid the sense of past is, and what where history begins and where history bumps into the present. It's just a cool thing to think about.
It is. And it's funny, I was just the other day talking with a friend about a book set in the 80s, which, you know, I remember the 80s very clearly, and I realized it's historical fiction to a lot of young readers. And so anyway, yes, you're absolutely right. It's a whole generation, even though it's 16 years. So
Laurie, what is new in fiction?
Well, it's what I like to think of as Daniel Silva season, which comes around, feels like all the time, but I guess it's once a year. And here at Kirkus, it's, I don't know, he's got a lot of fans here. Whenever it's time for him to have a new book out, I start getting calls from like our publisher wanting to know if I have an extra galley, and various reviewers wanting to know if they can review it. So I had never read him when this started a few years ago. And then I did start reading him, and I can see what the fuss is about. He writes really great thrillers. His new one is called The Other Woman, and it's a bit different from his last few. His hero is a guy named Gabriel Allen, who started out, when the series started around 2000, as he was a Israeli spy, basically, and he was living undercover in London working as an art restorer. And over the course of the series, he's now the head of Israeli intelligence. So for the last few books, he was kind of at his desk. He wasn't in the field as much, and I think he's getting back into the field with this book. And the other thing that's different about this book is that the last few books were concerned with the Islamic State, and they were the villains. But in this book, he's gone back to the villain that you might, speaking of a sense of history, Vicky and Laura, the villain is Russia, kind of a villain from our past and our present. Gabriel Allen has to find the one woman who can reveal the identity of a mole that Russia has placed at the top of Britain's MI6. And it kind of extends all the way back to previous British-Russian spy scandals like Kim Philby and the Cambridge Five. And, you know, as usual with this series, it's really interesting to see the differences between the different spy services in, you know, different countries. And obviously, it just feels extremely up to the minute having a spy battle with Russia. And he doesn't mention Trump by name, but he does kind of talk about the American president who has a strange fondness for Vladimir Putin. And it does feel extremely timely, and not an escapist read like Baby Rhinos, but a really good book.
Laurie, it sounds so exciting. I love spy thrillers, and I haven't read any of Silva's. So when I heard you talking about it, I thought, okay, definitely going on my to-read list. But I wanted to recommend a read-alike that's nonfiction. It's MI5, not MI6. But I don't know if you've read Open Secret by Stella Remington.
Oh, no. She's the former head of MI5?
Yes. So she writes the Liz Carlisle spy thrillers, which are great. But I like Open Secret because it's her memoir of being not only the first female head of MI5, but also the first openly identified head, because before that, you know, their identities were secret. And also in the middle of all that, there are all these interesting domestic details about being a working mother and head of MI5, which, you know, there were times and I was like, oh, it's a lot to juggle working and, you know, full time having a child. It's, you know, my job is nothing like hers.
That sounds great.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Thanks, Laura.
Well, thank you all. So we hope you join us next week. We're going to be interviewing Guy Branum, the comedian. He's written for Chelsea Handler and Billy Eichner, among other really talented comedians. And he's done a lot of stand-up, and he has a really intriguing new memoir, which is not your typical comedian's memoir. So look for that one. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, buddy.
What's going on, man?
Hi, guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, the team, Loveline, man. You guys remember us from back in the day? Well, we're doing a pod, and we're doing it every day.
And we've been doing it for a while, and if I hear one more time people say, God, I loved you and Adam together on Loveline, and I'm like, yeah, we're doing a podcast. Will you please just join us at the Adam and Dr. Drew Show, please?
Right.
AdamandDrDrewShow.com. It's a great show. Come on now. Only on Podcast One. That's us, Adam and Dr. Drew Show. Just like the old days.
Doctor's orders.
Oh, man, you're funny.
Yep. All right. Let's go save some babies.
Let's do it.